The truth of the matter is that every human being, Christian or non-Christian, can enter into communication with the good spirit world, if he wants it in earnest, and if he seeks this communication in the manner described in this book. The one thing that everyone derives from communication with good spirits is instruction as to the true path leading to God. What he receives is the sermon of truth. Whether or not any further exertions are made on his behalf by God's spirits depends in each case on whether the individual fashions his life in accordance with the truth imparted to him, and to what extent he does so. Whoever merely accepts the sermon of truth from the spirit world but fails to act accordingly will receive no further gifts from above. On the contrary, he will even lose the contact he at first had with the good spirits. No more good spirits will communicate with him. Whoever admits the truth into his heart and strives to reform his inner life accordingly will receive evidence of spirit powers such as we find among the early Christians, and in a manner corresponding with the individual's task in life. Among the early Christians, too, not everyone possessed the same gifts, nor were the individual gifts bestowed for the sole purpose of benefiting their recipients. Rather, they were to be used for the general good of all. The Apostle Paul constantly emphasizes this fact. 195. Today, too, the smallest community of pious and devout men and women will receive the same things from the spirits of God that the first Christians received. The only requirement is that we strive with all our might for the good, and reject the influences of evil. Whether the group in question is large or small will never play a role in the workings of the spirit world of God. A picture of the manifestations of the evil and the good spirit world similar to what we have seen in the case of the Protestant clergyman Blumhardt is encountered in the experiences of the Catholic priest Vianney of Ars. 2. Johannes Baptista Maria Vianney lived from 1786 to 1859, hence a considerable part of his life falls within the lifetime of the clergyman Blumhardt. While Blumhardt was unfolding his beneficent activities in the German parish of Mottlingen, Vianney lived and labored in the tiny community of Ars in France. Because of his limited talents, it had cost Vianney great efforts to qualify for the priesthood. From childhood on he had devoted much time daily to meditation and prayer. This inner concentration, which he continued to practice all his life, as did Blumhardt, brought about the development of his mediumistic gifts, the prerequisite for the influence exercised on people by the spirit world. The same was true of Blumhardt. While the Protestant minister first witnessed the demonic manifestations through the medium Gottlieb Benditters of his parish, and did not experience the influences of both the evil and the good spirit worlds upon his own person until later, the curate of Ars was the only one through whom the spirits manifested themselves. No such effects were observed in any people in his parish or vicinity. In other respects, the experiences of both were the same. Blumhardt and Vianney witnessed similar activities of the demons, they also witnessed similar activities of the good spirits. Both received a very powerful spirit of healing. Both had the gift of clairvoyance as regarded past, present, and future events. Both were able to perceive the inmost condition of people by clairvoyance. The parishes of both pastors were miraculously blessed with the missionary spirit, and this gradually spread to far distant districts. Both became the goal of pilgrimages made by thousands of people tortured by the 2. Joseph Vianney, Leben und Werken des H.L. Johannes, Maria, Vianney, Pfarrer von Ars. 1930. Published by Jebr. Steffen, Limburg A.D. Lahn. Ing. Translation, The Blessed John Vianney, Cure d'Ars, Patron of Parish Priests. Trans. By C.W.W. The name Vianney, Vianney is variously spelled, cf. Appendix of Joseph Vianney's book. Square brackets contain corrections based on consultation of the cited work. 196. Consciousness of a sinful life, who went to confess their transgressions and to receive assurance of God's forgiveness. Both knew by inner inspiration to whom such assurance could be given. The coincidence in all these matters for these two men extends to the smallest details, enabling us to discover therein the workings of divine law. Also the laws according to which the demons communicated were the same in both cases. Let us now allow the facts from Vianney's life to speak for themselves, beginning with the demonic phenomena that occurred with him. In his biography, the part dealing with the demonic influences is introduced with the following words: "Let me first say a word here for the benefit of those who feel tempted to have doubts on this score, or to smile as they read the following pages. They will not be the first to do so. In fact, they will not form or express a single opinion on the subject that was not formed or expressed by the world during Vianney's lifetime, and which the clergy of his day expressed even more forcibly than did the laity. Scarcely had the rumor begun to spread that the curate of Ars was being persecuted by devils, when loud laughter burst forth from all the parsonages of the surrounding area. Forthwith all of his dear colleagues explained to the curate of Ars that he was a great dreamer and that his brain was ill, that the cave out of which his demons came was nothing other than the stewpot in which he allowed his potatoes to grow moldy. My dear colleague, they used to tell him, live like everyone else. Eat more nutritious foods, then your brain will get well and you will see nothing more of those devilish tricks." Pages 66 to 67. Vianney, it should be explained, lived very modestly, and almost exclusively from potatoes, which he cooked on the first day of the week for the whole week and ate cold. By the end of the week they had often become moldy. So, far from being a weak spirit who would become a victim to hallucinations, as his colleagues had convinced themselves, Pastor Vianney was by nature so hard to convince, that at first he would not admit it was devils that plagued him. It was not until he had sought in vain for an explanation of the peculiar noises that again and again disturbed him at night that he recognized their origin and nature. One day he heard loud knocking at the door of his house. Opening the windows, he asked, "Who's there?" There was no answer, and when the sound was repeated at the door leading to the stairway, he repeated the question. Again there was no answer. Inasmuch as he had stored in his parsonage some splendid vestments that had been given to him as a gift for 197. his church, he thought that thieves had tried to break into his home, and considered it advisable to take precautionary measures. He therefore asked several courageous citizens to keep watch for him. They came and stood guard for several nights, hearing the same noises but discovering nothing. A watch that was set in the belfry was equally unsuccessful. Violent blows were heard, but nothing was seen. This alarmed the watchman, and even the curate became quite frightened. One winter night, when he had again heard loud blows against his door, he sprang hastily out of bed, and went down into the courtyard, convinced that the culprits, if that was what they were, must have left their tracks in the new-fallen snow, and that one could thus finally catch them. However, he saw no one, heard no further noises, and could not find any footprints in the snow. There was now no further doubt in his mind that he was being persecuted by Satan. Pages 68 to 69. From the day on which he became convinced that the nocturnal rioters were demons, he felt much less afraid. In the meantime, the main efforts of the demons were obviously aimed at making his ministerial activities less fruitful by robbing his overworked body of its nightly rest. Everything about these annoyances seemed admirably designed to make it impossible for him to get any sleep. Generally, Vianney heard one of those monotonous noises that more than anything else are notoriously conducive to sleeplessness. Sometimes the noises sounded like someone sawing or drilling through a beam, sometimes as though a row of nails were being hammered in. At other times it sounded as though regiments of soldiers were marching by his door, as though a herd of sheep were trampling overhead, as though a horse were galloping across the tile floor, as though someone were drumming upon his table, as though a cooper were hammering metal bands on casks, as though every wagon in Lyon were rolling across his entrance hall, or as though an uproarious assembly were conversing in his courtyard in a foreign language. This last nuisance continued for several nights in succession. On another occasion he heard the door being opened and someone calling him curtly by his surname. He was also subjected to a world of coarse witticisms, among which the most frequent was "potato glutton." Moreover, his furniture was moved back and forth, and his curtains were pulled at with such force that he was surprised to find them whole in the morning. Pages 66 to 70. Great were also the inner temptations he had to endure from the evil beings, through which they tried to drive him to despair. We meet with the same thing in Blumhardt's case. Unfortunately, the descriptions contained in his, Blumhardt's, report of the demonic influences 198, to which he personally was subjected, have been deliberately suppressed in his biography, as I have already stated. In Blumhardt's case as well as in Vianney's, the sole purpose of the demonic ruses was to completely destroy, or at least reduce, the effectiveness of these two men in leading their fellow human beings to God. For this reason they tried to ensnare Blumhardt, through Gottlieb and Ditus, in the unfamiliar, to him, field of the demonic, and when these efforts had failed, to confuse and discourage him by external and inner opposition. With Vianney, they first tried to discourage him and to drive him to despair, using the Catholic clergy of the neighboring districts, who opened such a campaign of slander and insinuation against the poor curate of Ars and continued it for 10 years, that anyone else would have given up. When this brought no results, the demons tried to undermine his health by depriving him of sleep, an effort that they kept up all his life. It was only in his last few years that he seems to have no longer been disturbed at night. The similarity between these two men becomes even more striking when we compare the divine aid they received from the good spirits. In this respect, their experiences were identical. Their lofty divine gifts were bestowed on both only after they had been severely tried in battle with the powers of evil and their human instruments. Everyone who wishes to work as an instrument of God for the salvation of his fellow human beings, and to acquire the divine powers necessary for the purpose, must fight this battle. Christ himself had to fight this battle. His public activities, giving proof of the divine power residing within him, began only after he had been subjected for 40 days and 40 nights to the terrible assaults of the demons, and had resisted them successfully. The servant is not above the master. The reclamation of souls through the outpouring of a spirit of repentance and an inner mending of ways took the same course in Blumhardt's parish as in Vianney's, and, in both parishes, spread by degrees to the most distant regions. The first effect of spirits of repentance upon people's hearts is to awaken within them alarm over the sins and transgressions in their lives, and over the consequent separation from God. The inner alarm about themselves felt by people who have been touched by the spirit of repentance is so great that they find no rest until they have revealed their inmost souls to a faithful servant of God and have heard his judgment. They are irresistibly urged on by an unseen power, until they feel the divine presence in their hearts and have the assurance contained therein that their sins have been forgiven. The sensation of happiness that then fills. 199. Their hearts is beyond the power of human words to describe. Let the reader consult the biographies of these two men to learn more about the inner feelings of these converts. Vianney could tell at the first glance which souls did not require his help. He would ask them in a friendly way not to take up his time, occasionally telling them, "Go home and don't worry. You don't need me." The healing of ailing souls that could not cope for themselves was the main object of the curative Ars. The healing of physical ailments was in his eyes of much less importance. Vianney gave information to many about the lot of their departed dear ones in the beyond, whenever he thought it conducive to their spiritual welfare. He was able also to see into the future by clairvoyance, and so it might be said that while during his lifetime nothing aroused so much interest as his battles with the evil spirits, after his death all the world began to speak of his predictions. These, in almost every case, related to the well-being of individuals and not to the public good. To some of those who had reformed he predicted the imminence of their death. In other cases, he told third parties of the imminent death of a relative, so that they might be prepared for the event. He also saw, in spirit, images of events in the distant future that concerned persons with whom he was engaged in conversation. One day, noticing a man in the crowd that was waiting for him, he said, "Get back to Lyon as fast as you can. Your house is on fire," and so it was. On another occasion Vianney sent a peasant woman who had just confessed her sins home at once, telling her that a snake had crept into her house. The woman hastened home and searched all over the house, but found nothing. Finally, it occurred to her to shake out her straw pallet, which she had laid out in the sun to air. As she did so, she saw a snake crawl out of it. He directed a young girl whom he saw standing in the church to return home without delay, as her presence there was urgently wanted. Upon her arrival, she found her sister, who had hitherto been in perfect health, lying there dead. Once a woman came to us to confession who had gotten a bottle of an alleged miraculous remedy from a sorcerer. After Vianney had listened to her confession, he remarked to her, "You have told me nothing about the bottle that you hid in the bushes outside of ours." Even more frequent was his ability to read the secret thoughts and feelings of others. This gift invariably manifested itself in the case of particularly difficult conversions. It happened almost daily that Vianney left his confessional and beckoned to those persons who were the most pressed for. 200. Time or the most unhappy, so that they might be the first to receive his attention. Among his visitors were some who merely came to test his gift. They left greatly humiliated. One of them confessed grave sins that he had made up. Vianney listened to him quietly, then said, "You indeed have much guilt upon your soul. But the evil that you have actually done does not consist of the sins you have just recounted to me, but of the following ones." Whereupon Vianney, to the great dismay of the impostor, revealed all of the foul deeds in the latter's past. Those who could not visit Vianney personally and were obliged to communicate with him by go-betweens or by letter were healed, advised, consoled or reformed by him at a distance. Every hitherto mentioned individual trait in the picture of the spirit forces working in Vianney's case also appears in kind and in extent, and, it might be added, identically, to the smallest detail, in the case of Blumhardt. It is difficult to say which one of the two, Vianney or Blumhardt, was visited by the greater number of people, who streamed to them in thousands and experienced in their own persons the miraculous workings of their powers. Another manifestation that was shared by both was what might be called a miraculous multiplication of the loaves. With Blumhardt it happened that, owing to the great influx of outsiders who were hospitably received and lodged by his parishioners, a serious food shortage developed. Yet, a special blessing presided over these meals. One family, which did not have enough food on hand for 14 people, managed to give 42 people enough to eat with food left over. In Vianney's case, an even more apparent miracle is reported, which was witnessed by everyone in his parish. He maintained a home for poor children. One day there were no provisions left except a few handfuls of breadfruit in the granary. With a heavy heart he made up his mind to send the children away, but before doing so, he offered one more prayer to God for help. On going back to the storeroom he found it filled to the top with grain. All of his parishioners likewise climbed up to the granary to see the grain. The event caused a great sensation throughout the entire district. Even the bishop later came and had them show him how high the granary had been filled. If we compare these two men as instruments of God, we cannot fail to notice a very important point. We have before us two men of radically different creeds: on the one hand, a Catholic priest, who venerates saints and relics, who attributes all cures to Saint Philomena, who celebrates Mass and regards confession as a sacrament essential to the forgiveness of sins, who, 201, believes in transubstantiation and holds fast to all other teachings of his church, and on the other hand, the Protestant clergyman Blumhardt, whose creed is diametrically opposed to Vianney's, who categorically repudiates the adoration of saints and relics, the Catholic Mass and sacrament at the altar, the Catholic form of confession and absolution, popery and everything connected therewith as not ordained by God, but deriving from human errors. And yet, under the hand of God, both rank equally as instruments for delivering mankind from sin and from Satan, and for guiding it back to the home of the Father. Both, in spite of the differences in the tenets of their respective creeds, receive the highest gifts Christ promised to those who believed in Him. In one respect they are alike, in their profound faith in God and in their consequent unshakable trust in Him, as well as in their great love of God and of mankind. Before God, therefore, The religious denomination to which a man belongs is of no weight. He regards it only as an outer garment hung on people's shoulders that has no influence upon their spiritual personality. If this is imbued with faith in God and with a love of God, he allows people to retain this garment, this patchwork of human errors, as long as it does not obstruct the task that he has assigned to them. If one should ask why the good spirit world did not enlighten these men as to the errors in their religious views and inform them of the truth, the answer is not difficult. In the first place, such enlightenment was not necessary, because the doctrinal errors in no way obstructed the work that God had assigned to both. They were called upon to persuade the people of their immediate neighborhood and those somewhat farther afield to search their hearts and to return to God, something which neither the Catholic nor the Protestant creeds stood in the way of. Above all, however, the spirit world could not enlighten either Blumhardt or Vianney as to the errors of his religious doctrines without making the fulfillment of their duties impossible. Had the Protestant clergyman Blumhardt received any new insights into the truth, he would have to have altered his teaching accordingly. He would thereby have placed himself outside of the Protestant Church and thus lost his position as well as his sphere of activity. The same thing is true to an even greater extent of the Catholic priest Vianney, for had he departed in only a single point from the doctrines of his church, he would have been done for in no time. 202. Among Catholics, the task of saving souls could be performed only by one who wore the robes of the Catholic faith, just as Blumhardt could hope for success among his co-religionists only as a representative of the Protestant creed. Even as it was, the efforts of both were attacked beyond measure by their own colleagues, although each of them was devoted to his church. How much more, then, would they have been opposed, if they had departed in one point or another from the doctrines of their respective churches? In Vianney's case especially, there were no bounds to the attacks by his colleagues. As already mentioned, he was persecuted, criticized, reviled, made the object of suspicion and slandered by them for 10 years, and he was even threatened with extreme violence. When the Catholic clergy of his immediate and more remote neighborhoods saw their parishioners also hastening to Vianney and paying more heed to his opinion than they did to those of their own priests, envy and jealousy reared their heads. They spoke of him as the ignorant priest, who had barely been able to acquire a little Latin and had nearly been expelled from the seminary. Above all, the enthusiasm with which people spoke of the curate of Ars caused the hatred harbored against him by the other clergymen to overflow. He was slandered most shamelessly. Priests forbade their parishioners to go to Ars for confession and threatened them, in case of disobedience, with exclusion from the sacraments and denial of absolution, even in the hour of death. Sunday after Sunday they inveighed against the curate of Ars from their pulpits. Speaking of this in later days, Vianney once said, "The gospel was allowed to rest in the pulpit. Instead, everyone was busy preaching sermons against the poor curate of Ars." While some ridiculed his ignorance, others cast doubts on the life he was leading. He received countless anonymous letters in which he was accused of the greatest baseness in the vilest language. The clergy even tried to incite the public against him. Mornings, on opening his front door, he would find it covered with placards accusing him of having passed the night in the most shameful debauchery. Here, as well as in Blumhardt's case, we find a repetition of what the Jewish priesthood did to Christ. What are we to do? See how the multitudes run after him, this wine drinker who associates with sinners and whores. The popular sayings about clerical jealousy and the fact that one clergyman is another clergyman's devil were again confirmed in the case of these two clergymen. 203. Even if the attacks made on Blumhardt by his colleagues did not reach the level of meanness of those delivered against Vianney, he nevertheless had to endure much suffering and persecution at their hands. If such a life and death battle was waged against these two men despite their faithfulness to their religious creeds, imagine what would have happened had it been possible to prove that they held views in conflict with the teachings of their churches. God and his spirit world, in selecting and preparing their instruments, take into consideration the conditions of the times and the religious atmosphere that prevails in the circles in which these instruments are to work. human opinions and errors are ignored by God's spirit world, as long as they do not constitute a serious obstacle to the attainment of the goal it had set. Not a single one of Vianney's erroneous religious beliefs was corrected by the good spirits that appeared to him, because these errors in no way interfered with the task he had to perform. Only when he, as a result of his mistaken views on physical penance, which he regarded as particularly pleasing to God, undertook to rack his body with penances, did the spirit world intervene and teach him. Such intervention was imperative, since a weakening of his physical strength would necessarily have resulted in a corresponding loss of effectiveness of his efforts. A commanding voice, which he heard by clairaudience, reminded him of the real task that had been assigned to him. Speaking of this incident, Vianney says, "I do not know whether it was really a voice that I heard, or whether it was a dream. At any rate, it woke me up. This voice told me that it was more pleasing to God to save the soul of a single sinner than to offer all kinds of sacrifices. This happened at a time when I had resolved to do penance for my own sanctification." Vianney, the Catholic priest of Ars, was canonized by his church. If it were within the power of man to canonize man at all, then the Protestant clergyman Blumhardt would be entitled to the same honor, for in point of character and effectiveness, and of the amazing gifts with which he was endowed from on high, he was in every way his Catholic fellow clergyman's equal. The lives of these two men show that the good and the evil spirit powers are as actively involved with mankind today as they were at any time in the past, and that their workings are subject to the same laws. 204. Spiritism in the light of modern science. Prior to when I became acquainted with communication with the spirit world, I had no knowledge of the possibility of such communication, having read neither books nor journals dealing with the subject. Similarly, throughout the time in which I was receiving from my guides in the beyond the teachings recorded in this book, I had no contact with other spiritistic circles nor did I consult any spiritistic literature. As a clergyman, I devoted my full attention to the truths that were imparted to me week by week through the mediums and that, more than anything else, caused a fundamental change in my religious views. My hours of study were devoted to the scriptures, as I was eager to learn whether the new truths that were demolishing the structure of my previously held beliefs agreed with the teachings of the Bible. The Holy Writ was my criterion. Moreover, the spirit world was constantly urging me to compare my newly acquired knowledge with what is in the Bible. At our religious meetings, the spirit that manifested itself regularly took up the Bible and explained its contents. However, after a certain time, when I had absorbed the new picture of the truth, and it had become my firm conviction, I was told to acquaint myself with present-day spiritistic phenomena. This would give me the opportunity of testing and interpreting these phenomena in the light of the laws imparted to me. Should I witness anything that I could not understand, I could obtain the desired explanation by asking for it at one of the seances I attended. From the outset, I resolved to test only those phenomena of whose genuineness there could be no question. At about that time, early in 1928, I heard of a scientific journal published with the cooperation of eminent professors from almost all countries, and devoted to the discussion of occurrences that cannot be explained by any known natural laws. This periodical is entitled, Zeitschrift für Parapsychologie 3, Journal of Parapsychology. Parapsychology is the science of things beyond the scope of the familiar laws governing the psyche. I used the 1926 and 1927 volumes of this journal, the earliest published, as the material for my comparative studies. The facts related therein are so thoroughly substantiated as to leave no room for doubt. Zeitschrift für Parapsychologie, Oswald Mutz Publishers, Leipzig. Text in square brackets is added as an explanation or is a correction based on the cited source. 205. Regarding their authenticity, and they embrace all phenomena observed in the realm of spirit communication. To be sure, the periodical confines itself to reporting the facts. Opinions differ widely on how these facts are to be explained. Modern science refuses to recognize the existence of a spirit world responsible for these phenomena, and it is only very occasionally and with the greatest reluctance that a scholar will mention the possibility of intervention on the part of spirit beings. Instead, explanations are concocted that must strike any normal person as absurd.